Thank you. It is, as Rob introduces me, when you live on the road, as I often do, it's a tremendous privilege to get to know, to meet people that you would never, normal context, you would never have access to be able to have conversations with. And I'm not here to advertise their organization. That's not the point. But I want you to know that at least as I have met a number of the staff, and certainly as I have gotten to know Rob, I always make a core decision. Is this the kind of person that I would be able and willing to sit and talk with about some of the most significant battles, significant shame and heartache? And I felt that with Rob from virtually the first encounter. Like, here is a man who will care for my story, not merely kindly, but also inviting me to become far more. We're going to talk about vicarious traumatization. That's the topic for this morning. And one of the core things that you will hear me say toward the very end is this issue will not go away. There are many things in life that you can put off. It took me years to actually get committed to flossing. Do you all floss? Like you do. That felt like a majority. Like you all floss. Well, I was the kind of person who knew, like many things in life, like it would be good to floss. And every time I would go twice a year to the dental hygienist, and my dental hygienist is a neo-Nazi. She's a deeply deprived and powerless woman who finds extraordinary place and power in that locale of the mouth. And so every time I would go in, she would ask beforehand, "Are you flossing?" And she knew the answer. And the first little thread that goes in and the gums bleed, she knows the answer. The answer is, of course not. And it took so long each time to shame me, for me to make a commitment to, again, I will floss eventually, and then I wouldn't, and then come back. And eventually what she said to me was, Do you understand what's happening with tartar? And do you know what tartar is, really? I thought tartar was the debris of food left between the teeth. I really did. I thought that's what tartar was. But and that's the answer I gave her when she asked, "Do you know what tartar is?" And she said, "It's not. It's not." She said, "They're living organisms." And then she said, "They're like a kingdom. It's like a kingdom, like a dark kingdom in your mouth. And each and every day you don't floss, they gain more and more power, and they work to destroy both your gums, your teeth, and eventually, literally, will open the door to a heart attack." And it was like, freaked me out. Like, open your mouth, look in the mirror, like there is a dark kingdom in there at work against you. And that narrative was enough that I won't say that I have been consistent like 1,000% since that day, but it's been about 3 years and I'm a flosser. Like just the thought that there's this kingdom operating, there's just times I floss when I know there is no purpose whatsoever just to disrupt that growing kingdom. Here's my simple point, and that is vicarious traumatization is a lot like tartar. And it's operating quietly, mostly underneath the surface. You can go weeks, months, years, and sometimes almost a whole life in ministry and not address it. But I can tell you, without any question, if you don't address it, it will take you down. It will minimally take away your capacity to live out your calling through many, many decades. I've been even hesitating saying the words because it's the first time I've said it publicly outside of the school that I teach in. A dear friend of mine, this last December, a pastor who had been a remarkable presence both in my life and the life of his people, took his life. Man I've known for almost 40 years. I probably have done more conferences in his church. If you know my work on sexual abuse, his church was the first church that asked me to do a conference on sexual abuse. To this day, most churches don't want to mess with the category of sexual abuse. Even in the presence of the Me Too culture, most churches still want to somehow keep their head in the sand. But this man and his community was the first back in 1988 to invite me to do a conference. I was with him. I did a conference in his church, actually a simulcast, 6 weeks before he took his life. We had many walks. We went 2 days early just to hang out with Bill and Janet, and he was depressed, and he was having beginnings of panic attacks, these were conversations that were not new. We had had many conversations about his life, about his ministry, about his relationships, about his mom and dad, about his life. And so when I come to this today, I would have had an energy to be here and a sense of it is good. This is a good place for me to be. I want to be here, but there is a more haunting sense of Bill could have been sitting in this group and he would have taken the material that I'm about to teach quite seriously. The job you have as a pastor, irrespective of what name you are given for the work that you do, I say to you, I think is the hardest work any human being does on this earth. I do not know a more difficult job than you in any role of pastoring in the community of God. And so the complications and the exacerbating heartache that you address just daily, if you think for a second that you can escape vicarious traumatization, on behalf of my friend Bill, I would like to shake you. And if I could shake you with utter kindness, shaking implies a certain level of violence. If I could erase that and say, please, don't take this topic in a way that becomes academic or just interesting or, oh, could be possible. How could I not have some level at times of emotional fatigue or burnout? Those are fair categories. And again, because I don't intend this to be sort of an academic lecture, we could spend time trying to differentiate what normal kind of emotional exhaustion is versus burnout versus vicarious traumatization. But what you need to hear is the notion of trauma implies certain biological consequences in a way that, yes, emotional fatigue does as well, burnout does. But when we talk about vicarious traumatization, we're talking about trauma effects. And so those issues are not going to be resolved because you got an extra week of vacation. Or you got maybe this glorious gift of a 2-month sabbatical. Again, an extra week would be indeed delightful. And literally a mini sabbatical can be life-giving. But you need to hear it's in many ways like tartar. It's not going to go away. It's going to continue to have a acidic effect upon your body, your heart, and your mind. And so if there's any topic, where I can keep saying, no, you need to talk to Rob, and you need to talk to this lovely back row, which I just think it's hilarious that the therapists sit on the back row. I'm not going to do this to you because you'd resent me even more than you might to have you all come up front. But you know you're in a Presbyterian church when nobody will sit in the front. I'm sort of Presbyterian, so I can say that. Well, let me see if I can organize what I would wish to say. First, I mean, this is so painfully obvious. Do you know that your job is difficult? I mean, preach and teach, right? And not just preach and teach, but administer. And not just administer, but work with crisis-oriented heartache, hospital visits, chaplain, as well, you run small groups, you also interact with elders, deacons, and you're also fundraising, if not fundraising directly, indirectly, inviting people to give their gifts, their time, their talents, money, your conflict resolution, you're a mediator. How many jobs did I just mention? 10? 10, 15? And you're meant to do that seamlessly from one moment to one appointment to 1 hour. And what level of support generally do you get in the context? Again, not to blame elders, not to blame. I mean, almost everyone that you work with, other than a few staff, are volunteers. Nobody gets quite what you have to hold. So the factor of having trauma through other people's suffering has been researched well enough that, again, to go into the details to invite you, you can just look up Google Scholar and type in vicarious traumatization, and you're going to see that this has been a forceful study, in part because we've had people and NGOs caring for people in highly traumatized settings. And what we're finding is that the average NGO costs usually to have somebody on the field. So somebody in Haiti, somebody who's gone to Syria, somebody who's gone to Afghanistan to care, just again, secular, Christian, doesn't matter, NGOs. Most of the time to prepare a person to go into the field, the estimates are between $75,000 and $150,000 to prepare a person to get into the work. Then the question is, if you've been to school, you've been to seminary, or wherever you have gone to be prepared to do what you do, you start adding up the money. What is the length of time people remain in highly traumatized settings? 18 months. So is it worth preparing somebody to work in the realm of human trafficking in Addis Ababa? Not really, because $100,000, $150,000 for about a year and a half worth of work. The turnover rate for NGOs, so there's a reason culturally we've been studying vicarious traumatization for quite a while now. And it's been applied. There's been studies done with pastors. It's a little more subtle with pastors because you're usually not in a war zone, or at least an obvious one. You're not dealing literally with severely broken bodies as a result of war or other forms of natural disasters. Nonetheless, because of the subtlety, if you'll hear the phrase, because of the subtlety, it may be less overt. Therefore, it's more hidden, and therefore has more long-term effects. And if we begin that process of saying, what comes with any form of trauma, any form of trauma? You've been in an accident. You were sexually abused. You live in a world like I just described. What comes with trauma? And I want there to be at least three categories, maybe four, as we evolve. The first is this. There will always be a form of fragmentation. When you're in trauma, what happens, as we've come to understand far more clearly from fMRIs, from being able to actually assess trauma in process or in some form replicate it in experimental fashion and see what happens to the brain. But basically what shuts down is your left frontal lobe, particularly an area called Broca's area, which basically manages our capacity for language. But it also is that central area for what could be called executive functioning. Your ability to manage crisis literally gets fragmented, at least over time, as a result of trauma. About a year and a half ago, Becky, my wife, woke up and she had some severe pain in the back of her head. It seemed to dissipate, came back later that day, and the next morning when she woke up, it was there full solid. She was having what's called occipital neuralgia, and it's a firing, electrical firing in the back portion of your brain, and she was having these kinds of impulses at about 30 to 40 per minute. When I asked her, what level of pain are you in? Her response was about 9. And I'm thinking, you're experiencing virtually almost every second this impulse, electrical impulse, that literally is a level of a 9. And how long are you going to be able to survive? This went on day after day after day after day. Of course, we're calling physicians. We're trying to get her in to a neurologist. I don't know what your medical care is like, but we were able to see two neurologists, one 6 weeks in advance, the other 5 weeks. So my wife is going to be in bed, literally, like being electrocuted for 5 weeks or 6 weeks. I am frantic. I'm making every phone call. I have friends who are physicians around the country, calling them, saying, do you know any neurologist? Do you have a relationship with any neurologist in Seattle, Portland? We'll fly anywhere just to begin this process, because I could not imagine for 5 or 6 weeks. Again, that portion of the story, she was actually able to see somebody about 2 weeks in. But during those 2 weeks of her being in literally agony every single moment. At some point, she said, we have to eat. We have nothing in our kitchen. You need to go shopping. She told me later that, though that was true, she also sent me off because she couldn't stand my care, which is another word for the word worry, panic. I was oppressive in my care. Like when you get asked, you're already suffering. Is it any better? Are you okay? That was bad. Was that a bad one? I mean, get out. I mean, therapists are fairly useful in certain settings, but for the most part, I think we're better off just staying in our offices. I speak for myself. So I got sent off to our grocery store. And I had a list that she had helped me make up, and I went in. And as soon as I got in, I literally stood in sort of the foyer and looking at my list. And I can't tell you to this day how long I stood. It could have been 2 minutes, could have been 5 minutes. I have no clue. That's one of the things that happens with trauma. Fragmentation creates a kind of timelessness. In part, again, don't want to bore you with neurological facts, but when you're in trauma, a portion of your brain called the amygdala, and there are two words that you probably ought to have in mind. The amygdala is that part of your brain that's constantly on edge, watchful, thoughtful, impulsive, basically in charge of making sure you don't die. Every single second, it's online, basically going, where's the tiger? But generally, it's calmed by another portion of the limbic system called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is, in some sense, like a comforter, a narrative comforter that's able to go, no, this is okay. You're going to make it through this. We've gone through something similar to this. So those two portions of your brain, my amygdala, which pumps all sorts of stress biochemicals, adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol in particular. I'm being flooded in the context of this grocery store because I have a task. Normally, I'm just looking at my wife going, is there anything I can do? But now I'm actually in a place where I've got to make decisions. I've got to get, what do you call that? Cart, yeah. Got to get a cart, put things in it, fulfill the list, and I'm overwhelmed. I mean, I'm kind of lost, and I don't know how long, but someone came up to me, one of the women who works in this grocery store, came up and didn't get real close, but came close enough, and she said, do you need help? Do you need help? And I looked at her, and I cannot tell you how young I felt, the word sort of tumbled out, and what I said to her was, my wife is sick. And I was near tears, and it was very simple language. My wife is sick. And one of the things she did, I don't know how they train folks in this particular grocery store, but she put her hand lightly on my shoulder, and she said, you have a list. Can I help you? And she took the list from me, and she got a cart. She brought the cart back, and she said, you can push it. It was so brilliant. Like, take the complex list from me, because I will not be able to go through this, but I'm going to give you some agency. I'm going to let you actually push the cart. And we went aisle to aisle to aisle, picking up all the things that I need. That's what happens in trauma. Bright, capable, competent people can't find their keys, can't remember what they're about to talk about. They know their outline, but they can't hold it together. So you may just think that you're aging, and things are just hard to remember quite in the way they were. That's true too. But what I would say is, you need to know when there are periods where, even though you're highly competent, you're not doing the things that you've done as well as you used to. And that's probably a sign of trauma. Not a sign of age, not a sign you're kind of losing it, but you're beginning to come unglued. Second portion of trauma will be not only fragmentation, but a kind of numbing. Kind of, again, the word we would generally use would be dissociation. A kind of, I'm distant from. When my wife called me, I was at a conference. My wife called me to tell me that our dear friend Bill had killed himself. And she said, the way she began this phone call, she said, are you alone? And I said, I am now. I'm back in my hotel room. And she said, are you sitting? That's not good. I mean, you already know, and I'm so prepared that it has to do with our children, or one of our grandchildren, and I said, hold on, and she assumed that I went to sit, and I didn't, but as soon as she said, Bill took his life. I've got some level of command about the English language. Bill took his life. I know what that means. It's as if I could not hear it. And I said to her, say it again. And she said, Bill took his life. Bill killed himself. Bill who? I already knew who it was. I could not, the fragmentation was already at work. And when it finally became clear who she was referring to and what he had done, I had made the mistake. I was not sitting. Literally, my legs, I fell to the floor. My body could not hold the data of this loss. And what occurred in the next probably 45, 50 minutes was I couldn't think, and the next phrase is I could not feel. I could not carry on. I couldn't carry on the conversation with Becky. I just said, I need to hang up. And I thought I was going to pray. I didn't pray. I don't know what happened for 30, 45 minutes until she called back and said, I need to know what's happening for you right now. And at that point, I could have been 30, 40,000 feet above this, a 1,000 miles from her. It's as if my heart was walled off. There was nothing more within me that could manage the tumult, the affect that was coming. And what we find, this is why I said there are three things I want to cover, maybe four, but often what happens with numbing is a kind of relational distance. Because the way we keep ourselves intact is to not engage in relationship with others. I still see that as a form of internal and relational numbing. And so can you learn to live in the midst of that fragmentation that comes and basically lands on you about 10 o'clock at night? You're functional all day long. 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock at night, you turn the TV on because you have no more language. You have no more ability to be in the process of engaging. Can't read, can't talk, can't engage. And you're just distant, absolutely distant from the world. So if those two things make sense, then we come to this third category that almost inevitably comes. And that is what I'd call a kind of depleted addiction. Again, addictions are a very wide topic, and to address it in a kind of a few moments would not be adequate. But to just say there are a lot of us who aren't addicts in the normal sense of the word, but a glass or two of wine after a long day becomes a way that we not only numb, but we find a kind of insulation and satisfaction. If you actually look, and again, this is the kind of stuff where you go, oh, really, do you need to say these words? There's something called the HPA axis, hypothalamus, pituitary, and adrenal glands. And it's a kind of, almost like a train station that all our affect and behaviors runs through. And that neuroendocrine system basically regulates almost all of your ability to live. What happens is a level of depletion that lowers your ability to be able to function. But in that sense in which you are just, your body is strewn with stress biochemicals, while at the same time, your serotonin, your mood biochemical is deeply drops. So you're ramped up and your mood is low. The question is, what gives you at least a little bit of a oomph? Caffeine? Chocolate? Alcohol? Pornography? Netflix? All I'm saying is, those are not generally the major addictions that we would normally call forth and name, but they become our means to fill, to literally try to ramp our body back up. Another term that you need to have in mind is this term allostatic load. Our bodies are meant for homeostasis. You know, we breathe out and our body just calms. We take air in and our body actually ramps up. So when you breathe in, your adrenaline, your noradrenaline, your catecholamines, your cortisol actually pumps up just a little bit. When you breathe out, things begin to calm. Well, what happens is that our body is meant to have a kind of homeostatic structure, balance. But what happens with people, and I'll just say people like me, who teach, talk, interact, counsel, deal with crises in our school, in our church, in our friendships, in our families. I love this work because I love danger. I don't know about how you got into this, but I love danger. I love that sense of having the privilege to be part of a redemptive process. I love danger. I love redemption. I love people. I love to see people change. And the only place where you get to do that kind of work is in the midst of trauma. So I love the drama. I mean, don't you? I love the drama of trauma. It's where I believe God shows himself. But it's also where we are whittled down, fragmentation, numbing, and in some ways this form of depletion and addiction. And yet it becomes the new normal. So allostatic load means we're not in homeostasis, but our body has learned to adapt to the high level of tension and stress we're in, and our body actually goes, oh, so this is actually the new homeostasis. Well, it's not homeostasis. It's an allostatic load that's higher than anyone was meant to bear. Now, where's it going to show itself? In so many different symptom structures: overeating, sleep issues, where intrusive thoughts are able to come in, you can manage it. If you've not at some point had something akin to a panic attack, sleep disturbance, eating struggles, Relational tensions, and to me, the big one, though you'll think, whatever, cynicism. Just a growing sense of whatever. You know, that's just the way people are. It's how institutions are. It's how systems are. Just got to learn to live with it. I still get to do largely what I want to do, and I get to care and engage people. But, you know, as for churches, as for boards, as for schools, as for, you know, then you become a way of distancing your own. Cynicism is a form of distancing. So, again, I hope that's enough clarity to say, if you're in this work, and you're engaged with people, you're engaged in trauma. And not just the trauma of being involved with people, but the trauma they bring from their stories. And that's a whole category that we need to hear. And that is, when there has been research where your story, your own story, you're asked to write 8 to 10 sentences about an event that bore at least trauma at the level of a 3 or 4. So again, 9 or 10 would be, a very severe, heartbreaking rape. A 1 or 2 would be the loss of a favorite pet. But a 4 or 5 means it's significant, but we're not talking about some of the most severe trauma on the earth. You write 8 sentences about that event. They put you into an fMRI tube, and guess what happens? Just reading those sentences cause your brain to produce almost 60% of the stress biochemicals that you actually experience likely in the event itself. Then they did the same experiment with other people's stories. I read 8 to 10 sentences about your heartbreak, and they read my brain. It's not 60%, but it's in about the 35-40% realm. In other words, when you hear other people suffering, your brain does not differentiate that it's them, not you. Part of that is the glory of what's called mirror neurons. In other words, the basis of our capacity for empathy. I have a 5-month-old grandson by the name of Augustine. And generally we call him Gus. But every now and then in public, I like saying his name is Augustine. Just with the technology we have, you know, I videoed Gus as he was crying and then stopped, rolled over, and then I played it back for him. And his eyes, the moment he heard someone crying, I mean, doesn't have object constancy, doesn't know who he's looking at. All he knows, I don't know what he knows. I have no clue what he knows. All I know is his face registered a level of panic concern for what he heard and saw on that video. That's true for you, hearing any story. And so ultimately, where we're moving is, what are you doing with regard to your own trauma? Now, if you were here, was I here 3 years ago, 4 years ago? What I did was I talked about Leading with a Limp, a book that I did. And one of the things we did in that book was to do a research study on about 1,000, not quite, pastors, church leaders, people who would consider themselves in ministry. We did sort of a qualitative analysis looking at what were the primary words, primary categories people brought up. Let me just remind you of that. Number one, conflict. That was the first and most dominant word. What's it like to be in ministry? And the first major word is the word conflict. We are in conflict. Conflict with people in our church, conflict with a board. Conflict is part of your everyday existence. Even if you're tangentially involved in other people's conflict, what I've already said is, when you're involved even in other people's conflict, your brain does not make a differentiation. It registers it as your conflict. And therefore, your body is going to be ramped up at least somewhat with stress biochemicals, particularly cortisol. So your body, in the work that you do, cannot remain in homeostasis. Your body is going to be on this, at least, undulating process of rise and fall of traumatic tension. Second word that was used was the word betrayal. If you're in ministry, you've been betrayed. If you have cared for people and cared for people and supported them, a week, month, year later, they find fault that you weren't at the hospital this time. The fact you were at the hospital 8 out of 10 times, you weren't there in the 2 out of the 10 they needed you most. You cannot serve in the context of our era, in our culture, in this particular season of life, without in many ways giving away something that will not be valued and will be used. Something about you will be eventually used. Gossip, talking about you. If you've not had a blog or a book written about you, just wait. it will happen. So second word is betrayal. Third word, and this I want to interpret for you, but the word really is the word hurt. But often it was reflected as a kind of self-absorption. Like I think about myself sometimes way more than I think other people think about themselves. In part, you're always having to monitor your exterior and your interior and what's required. You have what I just went through earlier. How many roles do you have? Preach, teach, visit in the hospital, pray at a banquet. I mean, the roles you play are diverse, disparate, and in many ways maddening. And so you do have to change your hat. To change your hat, you've got to look in the mirror. To look in the mirror, it just means that in some ways you've got a kind of self-absorption that is not because you're a narcissist. Well, some of you are, but mostly because the job itself requires you check your teeth to make sure that indeed you flossed well. Fourth, exhaustion. I mean, I don't know how anybody does the work that we get to do without some level of, when you wake up in the morning, you need a couple cups of coffee. Now, if you know about caffeine, it replaces your normal rise of cortisol. So when you drink coffee, it's actually not a very wise, to say this in Seattle, I seldom do. I'm dealing with our industry that supports our graduate school. But bottom line, you know, the drugs that we use to get us in and engage the day generally are replacing our body's own natural way of creating energy to get into the day. But we are tired. And sometimes, I'm not trying to look at any one person, but you look around and you go, you're not a refreshed group. Final category, isolation. And as I said, I'm not here to advertise. That's not why I was invited. But this is a cure for isolation. Like if you don't have somebody who's kind, who's wise, who knows trauma, who knows how to read trauma and engage trauma, I'm telling you, tartar's going to kill you. And whether you leave here and actually take seriously flossing, I would be good. I would feel good that you actually started to say, I think I'll floss. But if you're a flosser and now you have a narrative, you really understand why, even better. But this is I can't even say strongly enough, you can't do this alone. You cannot do this alone. Who in your church are you going to come to and talk about conflict, betrayal, the kind of necessary self-absorption to look at your own face? Who are you going to acknowledge the level of exhaustion with? What you're going to find is that awareness is your number one cure. But you already heard me say this. When you're in trauma, self-awareness is not one of the great gifts that we have operating. You need the face of the other reading what you have come to assume to be normal. Your allostatic load is normal. And it's so freaking off the chart, it's just not normal. I don't know how to say it kindly enough. No one in this room is normal. You are not balanced. You do not live with a kind of homeostatic goodness. Why? Your job does not allow it. And therefore, the two-week break, the little mini sabbatical, it's, oh my gosh, it's helpful, but you need more than that. So the capacity to link our cortical brain, often referred to as our thinking brain, and our limbic brain. I mean, one of the things that I think would be so, I mean, I'm 65. I don't know how many more years, decades I have left on this earth. But I find as I age, if somebody came and gave me, said, we'll give you $100 million if we can take you and make you 40 again, be like, $100 million? You need to be in the realm of billions before I'm going to go back to 40. I'm way closer to meeting Jesus face to face. And I don't wish dying. I'm not fond of the thought. Death itself, I'm not afraid of. I will look forward to that moment of being received and seeing glory face to face. Here's the but. The kinds of things we have learned over the last 10, 15 years with regard to neuroscience, it's the one area where I go, I wouldn't mind staying around another decade or two to see what we learn about the brain. Now, I assume eternity will have libraries that we can go into and understand as much as God wishes to let us know. So it's not that I wouldn't have a chance to do that. But on this earth, to see the progress of what we know about the brain in trauma, the brain, just how it operates. It is mystery replete. And yet, back to this point, it's your responsibility to care for your brain and your body. And how we do so will come through our ability to link our cortical and our limbic systems. And you may know or may not have read much about this, but there are very few highways between our cortical thinking, and it's an unfair word to use here, but our limbic system, which is often referred to as sort of our feeling brain. The fact is, to think of our limbic system, what I was talking earlier about in terms of the amygdala and hippocampus, as feeling is really a misnomer. Because, especially on your roads, like your roads, like you don't need me to tell you about your roads. But if you operated cortically on your roads, you would be dead. You are making constant decisions with your limbic system. Literally, someone swerves in front of you. If you had to think through your options, you would be dead. But you are making major life decisions. In fact, the research indicates decisions like who you marry, like what job you're in, how you're going to handle it. Frankly, they're gut decisions. And when we say gut decision, what we're really saying is this, your stomach, is actually your second brain. Two kinds of cells transmit thought, neurons and then another cell called glia cells. And this stomach has probably 60, 70% glia cells. So a gut feeling is actually thinking. You're thinking through your gut. You're thinking through your limbic system. And again, what's to be said with regard to trauma? It all slows down and gets bound when you're in trauma. And so the only thing that you can do with regard to dealing with vicarious traumatization is, first and foremost, are you aware? Are you aware? And I've already said, you're not. Why? Because your allostatic load has become the new normal. And when you're in high levels of trauma, your brain's already fragmenting. So where are you to be able to address that kind of vicarious traumatization? The answer is only in relationship. I need to read your face for you to know that you're in trauma. I need to be able to touch your shoulder and to be able to say, do you need help? And no, I'm fine. And then to be able to say, no, you're not. No, I'm fine. Of course you're fine. You have operated at this level for so long and frankly so well, but it's eating you alive. And it will have unquestionable effects on your core relationships, your spouse, your children, your friendships. Well, you're already isolated. That's one of the words that pastors use to describe their lives, which includes isolated often from the primary people in their world. Until you can have your face read and your heart exposed, you're going to be in a trauma that will be locked into normalcy and, in fact, that is abnormal. So number one, you need relationships. Relationships not just to go play golf, not just relationships to, you know, go to In-N-Out Burger and have a nice talk. I'm talking about a relationship that is disruptive enough to expose in the presence of kindness. And if you've got a good friend who's able to do that with knowledge of trauma, knowledge of you, knowledge of the process, let me tell you, you won the lottery. Bless that good friend. All I know is my very best friend, I've told the story, if you don't know his name, Tremper Longman III, taught at Westmont for many years, just retired. Tremper's been my best friend since I was 13 years of age. And when I'm going through a really hard time, he is the first person I call. And Tremper, if you know him, he's a brilliant Old Testament scholar. And relationally, he's a kind, kind man. But in terms of dealing with a human heart, not so helpful. So when things are not going well, and I'm telling him, and he feels bad. He will grieve with me, but he won't pursue the things that need to be pursued. So I have to do supervision for him as I'm having him do surgery on me. And to be able to say, Tremper, I'm sorry, that's not the best scalpel, and it's not the right place. Here's a sentence to ask me. And I love him and deeply respect him, and actually in guiding him, good things happen for both of us. But it's just not what I want. I want someone who's got the skill, knowledge, but also has walked the path well before me. So the issue isn't degree. Bless the fact that the state of California requires certain degrees for your therapist to have acquired. But there are some people who are, frankly, plumbers, who run their own lawn services, who actually have more capacity to know and engage trauma than some therapists that I know. So I'm not lauding therapy as therapy. What I'm lauding are people like Rob, who do have degrees, but far more have a warrior's heart, but also a very tender heart to have the courage to step into matters that most people and most angels fear to tread. That's what you need when you're in trauma. You don't need just a kind hand. You need a wise, kind hand who's going to open the door not only for care in that brief moment of helping you find a solid foundation, but who's actually going to expose matters of your own heart to ask how it is that you will continue to live in the context of what causes you to keep saying yes. Is that really your job to just say yes? Do you answer every phone message? Then you're not just highly traumatized, you're not wise. Because you are giving away what you're not meant to give away, because Jesus walked by countless men and women who needed healing and he did not touch. If you are bound to engage each and every person you have the opportunity to, then you have not discerned what your kingdom is and how you're meant to live it out. Now that may cause you eventually to lose your job, because you may be in a place where you are literally required to answer every phone call within a certain period of time, every email within a certain period of time, and it's not even in your job description. It's just assumed that's the part of how you live. Well, already what we know is there are institutional issues here, that systemic issues that are actually creating a level of harm and abuse that will not lead you to life. And I should have asked, When am I to be done? 11:15. Okay. I will and want to make sure you have time for questions. So one, you need relationships with people of courage and kindness, with knowledge and wisdom, who will evoke and provoke, who will help stabilize, soothe, but will also invite you to more. Second, you need to care for your body. Again, I will not go back to flossing, but what I would say is what we have seen, particularly through Harvard studies, is the number one best way to engage trauma, vicarious trauma, is yoga. So if you don't do occasional downward dogs, upward dogs, cat, whale, my best is corpse pose. you can do home. You don't have to have Lycra. You don't have to have, you know, I mean, there's enough stuff on the interweb. 10 minutes is all research has indicated. 10 minutes. And if you don't like the word yoga, call it stretching. 10 minutes will change the level of your body's struggle. And what it gives, a fancy word, is proprioceptive awareness, meaning this relationship between our cortical and limbic system. There aren't many highways, and the one that is there is the awareness of your body. So asking this question more than a few times during a day, where am I feeling tension? Where does my body just... I just got out of a two-hour, knockdown, drag-out, pleasant conversation in a board meeting. Everyone was very nice, and the hostility was passive-aggressive. I was the primary recipient. And now, where am I holding that in my body? Where do I feel that? And now, how will you care? So, a massage therapist, yoga, you need to have the tensions in your body engaged. Exercise, fabulous. But many people, especially pastors, do things like they go run. And questions that just don't ordinarily get asked is, how fast do you run? Oh, I do about an 8-minute, 9-minute mile. That's not helpful. Guess why? Because when you run that fast, guess what happens with your cortisol? Could you run, a normal 8-9 minute mile, could you run a 14 minute mile? And I've had people look at me and go, like, would it kill you? Yes. Why? Because you're dissipating energy through that run. But you're not really. You're actually increasing it. So, second area, tend to your body with wisdom. And most of the things you need to do are slow. Slow. Walk at an amble for an hour versus walking fast for 20, 30 minutes. Why? Well, it's not much exercise. It's not the point. I'm not asking you to get exercise. I'm asking you to tend to your body, which will actually give you more awareness of where the tensions are in your body. So, relationships, second, your body, and the obvious third. And I say it, and it will sound like a little addendum. How is it that you pray? And do you pray on your face? And when is the last time you prayed and you wept? That's a question I almost always ask therapists. Because you see a lot of people, and can you hold the suffering of the people that you see without engaging? So a question like, how do you begin a day? I mean, what is your practice for the beginning of a day? How do you end a day? And as you end a day, do you go back through each person, each event, each process, and allow your heart not to evaluate it? Where did I do well? What did I not do well? Not self-absorption, but where you're able to bring the work of Jesus, his death, resurrection, and ascension, where you bring the cross between you and others, and you bless that person, but you also send back to them all their warfare so that you are not bearing ongoing trauma and stress of other lives. Oh, it doesn't mean you don't pray, suffer, and care for people, but where you're not taking any form of false responsibility. That's the context in which I think there will be both longevity, the potential for great impact, and for you, even greater joy. Are there questions before we end at 11:15? Or, yeah.
I've heard you talk before, and I read your book last year. It was the first book I read on my sabbatical, Leading with a Limp, and it was awesome. And so
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm glad to have joined. I hope we were in a good place.
We were getting in a good place.
Oh, I don't mean your heart. I mean just the space.
Yes, it was great. It was fantastic.
Okay. And your heart as well. But.
And it continues to give. My question, and I heard you say this last time you talked, and it stirred some anxiety in me. And then I heard you say it again today, and it's kind of stirred some anxiety in me a little bit, is when you talk about the body and about yoga and eating healthy and going to the gym and all the, you know, getting massages, those all are linked to price tags for me. A yoga membership. And I know I could do YouTube in my living room, but my 3-year-old's there and that's hard to do or whatever. And so the price of all those things, like that sounds fantastic.
Right.
And that is its own old category. And then the way that that looks, unfortunately, to maybe a spouse or a friend of like, oh, you get a massage once a week? You go do yoga? It feels hard to sell. One, from a financial standpoint, and two, from just like, what a lazy pastor. Like part of what you do is you get to meet with a counselor once a week and you get a massage and you're eating at Whole Foods and you're whatever those things are, but caring about your body. And so could you address that? Because I get that stirs in me with the body because I value that. I want to continue to put in that, but there's some barriers there that are holding me back from fully jumping into that.
Brilliant, brilliant. And again, if your spouse is bringing that data to you, all I'd want to do if we were sitting together is, so what's it like to live with him? Has this been exactly a bowl of cherries? I mean, if you're a pastor's spouse, and how is your life? Like, you don't know trauma? Talk to me. Because, like, you're living in Syria, and you think you're living in Southern California. I can do that better than you can because you're married to her. But I will not let a pastor, pastor's wife, or children think that they are in a normal job that has sort of normal parameters of stress and conflict. Trust me when I said there is no job harder on the earth, including the presidency of the United States. Nobody has a harder job than a pastor. So if that's true, and you don't just see that as my hyperbole, if that's true, then the question is, what do you need to do for longevity? And yes, there are occupational hazards. The financial issue is a big one. But to me, the time issue is where most people get caught. You know, money is big. Time is bigger. And so the fact that you're taking an hour to go to get a massage, and what I'd say is, if you think you can live without this, you're trying to live without oil in your car. And the price will eventually be that you're putting sort of bad oil in or no oil. You will seize. The engine will be ruined. I've seen it too often. And again, I go back to my friend Bill. He was on the border of taking a sabbatical, and for 3 years in a row, he said to his church, it's not the right time. Am I going to say that's the basis? No, but it's a factor in the fact that he eventually took his life. So I think first and foremost, you need to communicate to the people who have a potential to hear, and to those who don't have a potential, because whatever, they think, well, what do you do? I mean, you talk like 2 or 3 times on a Sunday. Like, that's hard work. Public speaking is the number one fear, more than death. So, yeah, it's a big deal. But if that were all you did, All I can tell you is that it isn't. And it's the complexity, again, of all those hats. So that's where my wife goes to yoga. She goes to a yoga studio. I've gone with her, and I just, you know, be it body issues, shame issues, I have a little 15-minute tape. I plug it in, and I mimic. And that's all I have the ability to do. I also have vertigo off and on, so downward dog is not the, there are all sorts of poses that are workable, and all I need is 5 to 10 minutes. You can do that. And things like TRX, you don't need a gym. TRX, $150. I can do almost an entire weight workout, anaerobic with that. So there are always ways in our world to care, but I'm going to go back. You got to craft time. But you can't do that without a narrative. That's why the story about flossing, when I finally got the narrative, then it became clear why I need to literally floss at least once a day, because there's a kingdom of darkness, at least in my mouth, and I'm not fond of the actual kingdom of darkness and want my whole life to be about saying hell no, but also heaven yes. Well, if I'm going to do that in a public sense, then I should at least be doing so orally. That's my answer.
So I really haven't noticed myself paying attention to all the shootings that have happened over the last 5 years. But this one just hit me like a freight train. I mean, I don't know if I woke up emotionally. I don't know if what happened, but I just, when it happened, I just sank. I mean, I just sank into my couch. So my question is twofold. What price is our society paying for me who lives in Southern California to know about so intimately, yeah, visually, what happened there? And then how do I engage what do I do now? I mean, who do I talk to? I mean, I want to go talk to them. I don't know.
And thank you. And yes, I think for many of us, here's the ridiculous sense. The last one, and then the last one before that, and then the last one, all are awakening. And again, I don't know where you are on AR-15s, the right to bear arms. Right to bear arms doesn't usually include a tank, missiles, and yet we, again, the discussion is going to be divisive, right? I mean, you cannot be preaching in our day without dividing. If your preaching is not dividing, then I promise you, you're not preaching. You're finding circular ways around. Do you understand what a complex day, you know, everything I was talking about before, I didn't even bring into it our current political, social, civil, racial, all gender abuse issues. So at least one of the things I'd be saying is you need to be talking about trauma. And the Bible doesn't have to have, you know, like, there's almost no place I can go in the Bible and not talk about trauma. And the fact that we know a lot more about trauma now, and yet scriptures know a whole lot about trauma. So how we talk about living in a fallen world, that's the word trauma. How do you live in a fallen world where your son or daughter you think is well that went off to school this morning, and there is no assurance they will come home this evening? My children are not in school, but I will have grandchildren, or that are at school, but grandchildren that will be going rising soon into junior high and high school. My gosh, I want to be there to protect each and every one of them. I cannot do so. So one of the things I'm saying is, will you talk about this in your settings? And will you use your story as a means to explore and expose the reality of trauma? And as a individual becomes traumatized, do you think that a group can't or a nation can't? So as we begin to address the dissociative structures, one of the ways we do that is through false narratives. We pretend that we're fine. We're fine. Well, if we begin to talk about race, are we going to tell the story that George Washington was a good man, he chopped down a cherry tree, couldn't tell a lie? That's the American narrative. We are good people, we do not lie. Well, I'm not saying that's not some truth, but do we have the ability to actually say, you know, the narrative's more complex. What we did to establish the country racially, what we did in terms of indigenous people, it has to be actually we grew this country in trauma by traumatizing others and by our own trauma. So can we allow trauma to actually be a category of reflection with regard to a hermeneutical lens for looking not only at ourselves and others, but ourselves in a larger culture? If we can't, then I don't think we're preaching the whole gospel. But the moment you do that, people come to church like they go to Disney World for a certain experience. And when you don't provide them, when you say, all the rides are shut down, thank you for paying, and we're going to come in and we're going to talk about this. Like, that's not why I went to Disney World or Land 4. I preached in churches not so long ago where one of the elders came up and said, you should be glad you got your check before you preached. And I said, I am glad I did too. And I said, and why is it that you are blessing? The check is in my pocket. Well, it wasn't quite the message we were hoping to hear, or at least I wasn't hoping to hear. And I said, did you want a message that would calm and soothe your heart in the midst of a difficult era? For sure. You don't invite me to be your primary soother. That's not my brand. So that's where, again, know yourself, know your world, but know the gospel. I think we are over. Let me just say thank you. What a privilege. I hope when I get invited back to Orange County that I have this privilege again. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Dan.